Welcome to the Living Daylights Boxing Podcast. I'm Zachary Olipi, editor of the Living Daylights, your source for boxing on the Fan Sided Network. And I'm joined, as always, by Diego Pelaez. We finally have a lot to talk about. It's fall and boxing is ramping up. It sort of had that big fight weekend feel last week for the first time in probably like a couple of months almost, you know?
Definitely, yeah. Definitely. There was a few big names in action over the weekend, some really great fights. You had arguably the world pound for pound number one defending the throne.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot to take in.
And that Golovkin and Gonzalez fighting again, although not on the same card this time. I think the last two times, or maybe even three, they'd been paired together and making a nice 1-2 punch for, especially for hardcore boxing fans, you know.
I appreciate that.
Really getting on board with that pairing. So, but it was nice, I have to say, to see Gonzalez get the headline on HBO for the first time. Definitely like an overdue accolade for him.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. He's bringing a lot of attention to weight classes, I think, that have gone largely overlooked.
Yeah.
Especially when you see a guy like Cuadras. We'll get to that. But,
yeah.
There's a guy that a lot of even boxing fans probably might not have seen before.
Yeah, exactly. Before maybe I'd known about him, but hadn't had the chance to see him
right. Live
or in like such a marquee billing. And now for the first time, you're seeing more mainstream conversations about potential fights at that weight or at those lower weights, I should say. But anyway, we're going to get to that, like you said. But let's start with Gennady Golovkin, who went to London, you know, to his immense credit. I don't think people talked about that enough, how he was willing to go on the road to defend all his middleweight titles, except for the WBA belt. They wouldn't sanction the fight, so he's, you know, he's got like 10 belts or whatever at this point. So he's defending a whole slew of them, three to be exact, against Kell Brook, IBF welterweight champ, who's moving up two weight classes, unlike Amir Khan when he fought Canelo Alvarez. So they fought at 160, and it was an interesting fight, but I do feel like there's been a lot of overreaction.
Yes.
On multiple fronts with regards to this fight.
I believe in our own text message exchange during the fight, I compared it to Hagler Hearns, possibly in a moment of over-exuberance, to be fair.
To be fair, but that was right at the end of round two when things had really heated up.
Yeah.
When I said that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just the fact that Brook was so willing to engage and really make this a firefight, which was kind of crazy, I think, frankly, tactically on his part. But it made for a hell of an entertaining few rounds.
Yeah, for sure. And I also think, too, I mean, you know, to be obviously you were, you know, we look back at that comment you just mentioned, like a bit tongue-in-cheek now, of course, but like, there were a couple of factors, too, playing into that. I mean, the incredible atmosphere just kind of ramped up the excitement. Anytime Brook was having success, you know, the Brits are kind of put everyone to shame when it comes to their, you know, fandom and boxing enthusiasm. So that really heightened things. I think, too, what you saw in the second round and into the third, I think Brook won the second round for sure. You could have, maybe if you bent over backwards, you could have given him the third as well. He had some legitimate success, you know. With a bit of distance from the fight, though, I kind of felt like this was a more exciting start-to-finish version of, you know, Kovalev-Pascal 1.
Yes, I actually had much the same feeling. I do think Brook was a little bit more effective than Pascal.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I would say that it was a better fight, for sure.
Right. I think what's going overlooked more than anything in this fight is that this fight was very close to being over about a minute in.
Yes.
Golovkin just creamed him with a left hook to the body.
And then went up top.
Yeah, and that
was staggered back.
That left hook to the body of Golovkin's is one of the scariest weapons in all of boxing. Yeah. When he lands that punch cleanly, you just feel like the guy is going down.
The way he turns that shot, you know, the angle that he
throws power
it,
he puts
crazy.
Into it is unbelievable. It's frightening, really, when you see him connect clean with it. And you saw Brook crumpled. He was gasping for air. You know, he was, his legs were rubbery. He was very close to going out in the very first round.
I don't know if you had a chance to look at the scorecards, but did you?
I did not actually get a chance.
Two of the three judges scored the first round for Brook.
No.
Yeah, I'm serious.
I mean,
he was ahead on the score.
I know. I can remember hearing that. That seems crazy to me. I mean, he had his moments, I guess. Maybe if you bend over backwards, you could give him three of the first five. I wouldn't have. But giving him that first round certainly seems crazy to me.
No, to his credit, I mean, he recovered. Well enough and had a mini rally at the end, but Golovkin had dominated the round.
And certainly did a lot more damage in round one. You cannot argue.
And even, of course you can't pay too much attention to punch stats, but, I mean, he did outland him 30-19 in the first round, and he did outland him every round, and of course you can't just look to that and say that means he won every round, but in the first round where he had Brooke reeling, the punch stats just reinforced that that was an obvious Golovkin round.
To me, I might have even gone... I mean, Brooke rallied very nicely, but without that rally, that you could argue even 10-8, frankly. Like, Brooke was hanging on for dear life.
He was.
He really was.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to ask you, were you watching the HBO feed?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I had the...
I'm thinking of the Gonzalez fight. I had the British feed for the Golovkin fight. Yes.
How absurd was the commentary on the Sky Sports feed? I mean, like, if I was reading somewhere, if you had closed your eyes and just listened to it, you would have thought Kell Brook had Golovkin out on his feet in the second round.
Yeah. I mean, they're exuberant for their guy. They're homers. We know this about the British announcers. And Brook, to be fair, I mean, had an exhilarating second round.
He did.
The way that he pressed forward with his combination punching, and the way that he really had Golovkin on his heels, which I don't know that I've ever truly seen before.
And what was interesting, too, is, I mean, if you look at the stats from that round, even though Golovkin slightly outlanded him, Brook outthrew him 71-60. How often do you see a guy outthrow Golovkin? Usually they're worried so much about what's coming at them.
Right.
But it was really impressive to see Brook take that initiative, but... Maybe that points to a little bit to what you mentioned earlier, the kind of strange strategy of almost standing toe-to-toe with Golovkin.
I mean, yeah, he seemed perfectly happy to get into a slugfest with Golovkin, which on the one hand, I think was interesting, because it kind of challenged Golovkin in a way that...
You can't run from him. He's too good at cutting off the ring, so at some point you have to fight. I stand and fight.
Yeah, I do wonder if he maybe has provided a blueprint for somebody else who's maybe a little bit bigger, a little bit more able to withstand the punishment. And I do think the hand speed of Brook bothered Golovkin at points.
Sure.
You know, he looked kind of human in this fight at certain points.
He did. And, you know, Pauly Malignaggi, who was on the British broadcast there, he made a good point, which is, you know, amongst the myriad things that Golovkin does supremely well, he doesn't move his head very much,
if at all,
when he comes forward. And you saw Brook have some really good success with the right uppercut down the middle. Golovkin ended up out-jabbing him quite badly towards the end of the fight, but Brook has a pretty nice jab, and he was landing some straight shots, too, on him as he was coming forward. So, you know, and his movement, I was impressed in the sense that he backed up, but he sidestepped, and he took those half steps back, especially when he had success landing the uppercut. You could tell he was drawing Golovkin into some traps. And Golovkin, too, I mean, you saw it in the fact that he wanted to brawl, you know. I was really expecting him, you know, to me the gold standard Golovkin performance is that David Lemieux win, where he just worked behind that jab with such methodical discipline, and I was actually expecting to see that, you know, as he kind of figured out Brook's speed, but it was almost like, okay, look at this welterweight coming up, let's see if he can hang. That was kind of the attitude he seemed to have, and he was pretty critical, you know, of himself afterwards, Golovkin was.
It was not his best performance, but when he turned it on in round four and five, you're reminded of why this might be I think he is the best middleweight in the world. Might be the best fighter in the world.
Yeah.
I think he's in competition with a handful of guys for that honor. And he showed it in those last two rounds. He just poured it on. And when he really starts letting his hands go and starts winging in that left hook to the body, it seems like, I don't know that there's anyone at 160 that can withstand that barrage.
Yeah.
You know, especially a guy like Kell Brook, who's, you know, a puffed up welterweight, maybe 154, he is where he settles in naturally, I think, at this point in his career. But 160 is a bit of a stretch, I think, for him, despite all the talk before the fight about how he's walking around at 180 and he's walking around bigger than Golovkin. I never really put much credence in that.
It's about how strong and effective you are at your fighting weight at the end of the day. Like, who cares if you're 220 and you're
It's about punching power.
Yeah, and if anything, you know, honestly, I look at that as more of a negative than a positive.
Mm.
If you're cutting, like, Ricky Hatton type weight, you know, that's not good for your body. Like, Golovkin, who walks around at about like 170 or something.
175, yeah, I'd say,
and,
probably.
And he's 165 3 weeks before the fight, you know?
Right.
This is a guy who's strong and comfortable at the weight.
Yeah.
You know, it's like an illusion that you have to be that much bigger than the weight you fight at. Look at Floyd Mayweather.
Yeah.
For example, when he was a welterweight, like he walked around like at 150 or something.
Yeah, I do think cutting too much weight can be a problem for guys over time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, what do we see next for either of these guys going forward?
Well, I mean, the thing with Brooke is obviously Golovkin broke his eye socket, so, you know, he has the surgery coming, and that kind of makes me wonder what's going to happen with Errol Spence, who's his mandatory challenger. My hope is that the IBF doesn't let Brooke kind of dawdle too much and that they just put Spence in for either an interim or vacant title, let him fight again before the year's out, because I don't see any way Brooke comes back in 2016. And he said he might even just decide to settle at 154.
I wouldn't be surprised at this point.
I think that's a good move, honestly. Like, as star-packed as welterweight is, I think Pauly made a good point that junior middleweight, even though it doesn't have the star power, is packed with talent. There's some great fights to be made there.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy like Kell Brook could come in and very quickly assert himself as, like, the big draw and the man in that division. So I'm intrigued by that. Of course, I'd love to see him fight Spence. I'd love to see him fight Keith Thurman. If he can make the weight, I'd like to see one or two of those fights first. But I do think his future is at 154.
I think so as well. You know, as he gets older, I think that weight cut is going to get harder for him.
Yeah. And he's 30 now, so he's in his prime, but he's getting to that point where cutting weight is harder.
It gets more difficult, especially for a big guy like Brooke. You know, as everyone was saying before the fight, this guy walks around closer to 180 than he does to 147.
Exactly. And looking at Brooke and the way he was able to stand up to Golovkin for as long as he did and the success he had, if I'm Amir Khan, I'm staying far away from that fight.
From Kell Brook, I think that'd be a bad idea for Khan, frankly, at this point.
I think Brooke's just too big and strong for him.
I just don't see any way that Brooke doesn't knock him out, frankly.
Yeah.
I think Brooke, you know, he's really coming into his own. He showed great fluidity, I think, in the Golovkin fight.
Yeah.
The way he was able to just let his hands go, I think in a fight against Khan, that'd be a big problem. He's got too much power, too much size for him.
And at the end of the day, I mean, the fact that he didn't go down, considering the barrage of punches he was faced with, is pretty damn impressive, too.
And considering his orbital bone seemed to have been fractured very early in the fight. I remember from, like, round two, he was pointing. You saw him pointing at it. And, you know, during the fight, you didn't really know what was going on there. But he many times motioned towards that eye.
And, I mean, you know, he was telling Dominic Ingle in the corner that he's seeing, like, four or five Golovkins, which is about as scary a prospect because I think you can face in a boxing
one,
ring.
One is plenty.
Yeah, one is plenty. But at the same time, I mean, ultimately, his stock goes up, and it just goes to show you that if you're a guy in Brooke's position, and, you know, I'm not saying that everyone should jump up two weight classes. It's certainly not for everyone, but you see the benefits, and we've seen it a couple of times, even for someone like Khan. You know, a lot of you rise in the esteem of a lot of people when you take on a big challenge, and you come out to fight.
Yeah, and he didn't come out just to survive at Golovkin and say that he lived to tell the tale, you know, that he made it to the 12th round against the Beast.
Yeah.
He went in there looking to hurt Golovkin, you know, and he got his attention.
Yeah.
It's not like Golovkin just steamrolled him, although that's the way this fight ultimately ended. Brooke, you know, had some very exciting moments. I think people are going to remember this performance. I think he's going to be back in a big fight as soon as he's physically able to.
Yeah. For sure, and as he should be. I mean, he proved that he answered a lot of questions in the sense that, you know, for Kell Brook, a lot of the stock we put in him had been related to the eye test. You know, his resume is thin at the end of the day. The Sean Porter win's a very good win,
but his
three title defenses have come against very pedestrian opposition. You know, size made a difference in this fight. Obviously, I think you would agree, Golovkin is the better fighter, but that's fine. You know, he showed that Kell Brook's the kind of guy who belongs in big fights.
Yeah, yeah, he had that kind of swagger to him, you know?
He had
that sort of, like, sense of the moment, I feel like, that of, like, really elite fighters have. And I think he's a great TV fighter, too. I think that's another thing that's going to help Brook going forward.
At the same time, though, I think you would agree that we can't just make this too much about Brooke and
that's a very good point.
And also, at the end of the day, this was an exciting, but like Kovalev Pascal, less to that extent, but still an exciting, albeit one-sided
He was absolutely one-sided at the end of the day. You can't deny that. And I do think, maybe because we both watch the British feed, all we can talk about is Brooke. But yeah, I agree. After the fight, I don't think enough was said about just how impressive Golovkin was in a kind of not one of his better performances even.
There's just a lot of people like either making excuses for him or saying this or that had been exposed, and it was just almost like, whoa, hold on, let's just take a step back and acknowledge that sure, Brooke was moving up, but this is also the fastest, most skilled fighter, almost like, you know, and Golovkin has a better resume than Brooke, certainly, but still, the big thing with him is he's missing that elite name. And of course, you want to see him fight that kind of guy at 160, but, you know, let's just kind of not leave it at this, but just kind of say that, okay, he had his moments where, you know, he was hit, worked through a bit of adversity, ultimately went on to dominate the fight against the most talented opponent he's faced to date.
Yeah, I mean, Golovkin is just a destroyer. He's a destroyer. He's methodical. He's like the Terminator, man. Yeah. He just presses forward, works behind that jab when he's at his best, although he was a little bit impatient with the jab in this fight, I felt like, because he just wanted to go in there, I think, and blow Brooke out of there.
Yeah.
But once he starts really, you know, getting the timing down and hunting you into that corner and digging that left hook in, I just don't know who can stand up to that. You're going to have to do like Brooke, though, I think. If you are going to beat Golovkin, you're going to have to just punch him in the mouth and, you know, take it to him and not let him just hunt you down.
Yeah.
You know, because like you said, the way he cuts off the ring, how methodical he is, how intelligent he is with his footwork, with setting you up.
He smothers drawing you into the traps. Perfect distance to throw his punches.
Right. And he's always got that equalizer in that left to the body.
Yeah.
You know, all it takes is one of those, and it totally changes the fight if he lands that flush.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that obviously we need to talk about the stoppage, of course, because a lot of people had some pretty strong opinions about that. And I was, frankly, a little bit surprised because, you know, Dominic Ingle, of course, seemed like he was waving the towel for like 45 seconds. And I'm a little ashamed to say that our Montreal ref, Marlon Wright, of the famous Boutte Andrade long count, was at the helm for this fight, so that doesn't look too good. But did people forget already that that Golovkin had landed 30 punches in the first minute of the fifth round and 25 power shots? Like, he was battering Brooke from pillar to post to start that round.
He was. I mean, Brooke's pride was getting the better of him, I think, frankly.
He was imploring him to, you know, come on, come at me, things like that. And that's what a fighter who's on the verge of being broken down does.
I think his corner saved him from himself, truly. Yeah. I don't have any problem with that stoppage. You know, it was going nowhere but downhill from there.
Yeah, and especially when you know what we know about his eye.
And that's going on a few rounds of fighting with a fractured orbital bone. You know, that you're talking about permanent damage potentially at that point.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very... It's one of those things where, like, a trainer in that situation, and, you know, Dominic Ingle has a lot of experience. He's been involved in a lot of big fights, but it's almost like you have to really be detached, and this is your fighter's moment, not your moment. So you have to be the one who's willing to pull the plug when you think that things are getting out of hand. Because, you know Brooke, he's just going to go out on his shield, of course, and that's a mistake.
Yeah, as the trainer, you have to be objective. You have to look at it as what kind of risk am I putting my fighter in, and do we have a chance to win this fight?
Yeah.
And I think Ingle made the right call on both counts there. You know, he... you want to keep your guy healthy. He's still young, in the middle of his prime. He's got big things ahead of him. Mm-hmm. And frankly, he had no chance at that point. Golovkin was battering him. It was just going to get uglier from there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, considering, you know, that the Canelo fight, they've had a nightmare time trying to make that. I'm talking about Golovkin now, obviously. And all the variables in terms of opponents they've made offers to, who've seemed like they were on board and then rejected the fight. I mean, what do you think this Brooke fight does for Golovkin? I mean, were you ultimately happy to see it as a matchup and a fight at the end of the day?
Sure. Yeah, it was a fun fight. I thought it was exciting while it lasted. Given the available options, considering everyone at middleweight seems to love talking a big game until it actually comes time to sign to fight Golovkin.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think you can really blame Golovkin here. He was offering this fight to anyone who wanted it. Canelo vacated a title to avoid fighting Golovkin.
Yeah.
Billy Joe Saunders turned him down.
$4 million, I think he was.
Chris Eubank Jr., when they were way down the trail, almost at the point where they just have to sign at the dotted line, he decides, no, I want a little bit more money. More than those $3 million or so, I believe, he was being offered for that fight.
For Eubank, probably. I don't even remember the exact
number. He was being offered a good deal of money, like a lot more than he's made in his career.
Both of those guys, career high purses, easily.
Not to mention, this is your opportunity to get yourself on the map.
Yeah.
You know, the who like Billy Joe Saunders, among the boxing purists, he's a name.
Yeah.
You know, he's a good fighter.
Yeah.
He's a guy who's deserving of a title shot.
Yeah, well, I mean,
he has his title. He's deserving of a shot at Triple G, I think, I should say. He's deserving of that fight. You know, and this what better step is there for his career? That's what I don't get by the handlers of a lot of boxing guys. It's like, what step do you think is better for your fighter at this point? Fighting another chump in England?
Yeah, and someone at like European level who they're gonna kind of try to sell as a worthy opponent for a title defense.
And what's the point? I mean, you're making a fraction of the money to beat up a chump in your backyard so you can keep the zero on your record. I don't get it.
It's that, and it's this faulty thing of, like, you know, the logic, and to me the false logic of, like, you win a title, just get a gimme first defense under your belt just to pad your stats. I mean, how does that actually help you as a fighter?
I don't get it.
Yeah.
I don't get it. Like, the money is in the big fights, right? Yeah.
And that, I mean, and you know, I wish more guys had David Lemieux's attitude at middleweight. You know, he could have easily milked that IBF title for multiple defenses in Montreal and put off the Golovkin fight, but he went into it right away. And okay, he got a good deal, but like the other guys, he was offered a good deal financially, and he actually took it.
Right. And I don't think he regrets it.
No.
Why not? I mean, he lost the fight, you know?
Would he have been more ready for Golovkin a year later?
No.
Golovkin's just a better fighter, and that's no slight against Lemieux. It's just a testament to how great Golovkin's is.
Better than probably anybody at this division, but we don't even get to find out because the top guys won't fight him. It's becoming very frustrating.
Yeah.
Well, this is an old song now in Golovkin's career.
And then, of course, Saunders and Eubank, who we've been talking about, had to get on social media after the fight. And they had to call out Golovkin as if they never run away from him with their tails between their legs. Saunders had the gall to call Golovkin Borat on Twitter. Oh, the Bore, B-O-R-E, which was so clever. And Eubank posted something on Instagram saying, like, my corner doesn't own towels or something, which is... You know, to show how macho he is. I mean, like, it's so pathetic.
I can't stand it. This is one of the things that, frankly, makes me wish that boxing had more of a structure like, say, UFC.
Yeah.
Where you could just force these guys to fight, you know?
Yeah.
Just force, like, I wish somebody could just, like, had the authority where just say, you know what, if you don't fight Golovkin next, we're stripping you.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
Right?
There's nothing else to it. Yeah.
That's all there is to it. Like, for Billy Joe Saunders, you're losing your title if you don't fight Golovkin and unify.
Yeah. So what did you think about the fact that... Because I didn't like the way people overreacted to this, because I thought it just showed a kind of misunderstanding of the situation. A lot of people were very upset that Golovkin called Saunders out after. Because he's like, I want to fight Saunders, I want that title. And people are like, oh no, what about the Canelo fight? What about the Canelo fight? Who gives a shit?
I mean, you
know, like, the fight's there. Calling him out is going to make no difference.
And the fight's there. I mean, everyone knows that it's there for Canelo to take.
Yeah.
Everyone knows that fight's there to take. I don't think Golovkin is expecting that fight before next fall, which is why I think he's calling out Saunders right now. He's clearly not going to wait until next October,
no.
You know, for his next fight.
No, I think that it's entirely plausible that Golovkin fights at least two, if not three more times before the Canelo fight. You think he's going to have one before the end of the year, one in the first quarter of 2017, one probably in the spring, and then before that fall 2017 fight.
Easily. Yeah. He could easily fight two more times, maybe even three, depending on, you know...
How tough the fights are or who he fights. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, that's one where I'm almost just kind of forgetting about the prospect of Golovkin Canelo until it's actually signed, because
until Canelo shows any interest in this fight, frankly. I mean, he has shown basically zero interest except a passing word or two about how he's going to give the fans what they want or whatever. Yeah. But he's shown no real interest in taking this fight, and until that changes, I'm okay with Golovkin calling out someone like Saunders, another title holder. You know, he wants to unify at middleweight.
Yeah, that's always been a big goal of his. You know, he's very committed to the idea of collecting all the belts. And if that's his goal, then great, more power to him. Let's just hope these guys step up and fight him.
I mean, the Saunders fight is a great fight. I mean, it's obviously not a huge blockbuster fight like Canelo, but that's a very nice fight.
Yeah,
I think very interesting test for both guys, really.
And Golovkin knows what has to be done to make that fight even more viable. He's going to go back and travel to the UK. He's not afraid to do that. He's done it already. He'll do it again. He said he would. And Golovkin, unlike most people in sports, is someone you can take at his word when it comes to stuff like that.
I don't see why he wouldn't fight in the UK again. They had a great crowd there.
Yeah.
Big live gate.
Yeah. What did you make, though, of the kind of ridiculous rumors about him being sick? And it was something that, like, Sky Sports seemed to be perpetuating, like, oh, look at Golovkin, he's not smiling, doesn't he look a little gaunt and stuff? And it's like, I don't know, man.
I don't know. This, it seemed a little, you know, I never really saw anything that was substantiated about that. It all seemed to be kind of speculation and rumor. You know, I don't know that there was anything there, really.
Yeah.
That story.
Yeah, yeah. And it was sort of fun to hate listen to Carl Froch do some color commentary, too. You know, that's always a good time. But, you know, they were enthusiastic. They were excited, the Brits. They had some reasons for that. I mean, they obviously blew it out of proportion, but that's to be expected. I don't think you could be, you know, too mad about that either at the end of the day. So, I mean, so what's our conclusion? Fun fight, well lasted, moderately intriguing matchup. Mm-hmm. Golovkin ultimately dominated, and Brook, assuming he heals up well, still goes on to do good things in the sport.
Yeah, I think Brook will win another title, probably at 154.
Yeah.
Yeah, I look forward to his next fight.
I'd still love to see the Errol Spence fight. You know, I'm hoping that he can get down and wait for that, because that'd be a good matchup.
It'd be a great fight.
Yeah. Let's talk about Roman Gonzalez, the guy most believe is the pound-for-pound number one in the world. He was moving up to and ended up winning a title in his fourth weight class, becoming the first Nicaraguan to do that, surpassing his mentor and the guy who was, you know, maybe until Chocolatito retires, viewed as the greatest Nicaraguan fighter ever, Alexis Arguello. So Gonzalez dethroned Carlos Cuadras in a really, really good fight. God, this was a good fight. Action for 12 rounds. You know, Gonzalez, the way he's able to apply pressure and his punch output over the course of 12 rounds is pretty stunning to behold.
Yeah, just the way, I mean, his brilliance is very subtle, I feel like, with Gonzalez. You know, a lot of guys at his weight class, you see the flashy hand speed, the kind of explosive athleticism. And Gonzalez isn't really that guy, you know? But he's so methodical. The way his head movement, his guard, the way balance. He's able to slip and counter, right, his balance.
Yeah.
Just his relentless, forward motion. But he's not just barging forward. He does it so intelligently. You know, the way he kind of breaks you down with his guard, even, as he's coming in. You're trying to get a hold of him, and he's just able to kind of turn you, you know, slip a punch here, there, hit to the body. What was the most impressive thing about Chocolatito to you from this fight?
I mean, I think the way he showed, because I think in the last few times we've seen him on HBO, he really hasn't had to kind of deal with any adversity, you know? And he was faced with a guy who I think had superior hand speed, which was interesting. And because when Cuadras was really able to open up with those combinations, he tagged him and he threw really well, like, body up to the head, and so he had some really nice flurries. And the way Gonzalez was able to kind of take those punches but not let it really disrupt his rhythm, you know?
Yeah.
He was never drawn into a fight that he wasn't happy to be in. You know, I think it was very close, mm-hmm. but I never felt that he either, you know, lost his discipline or lost his focus at any point. He really stayed on the task at hand. Even when Quadros had, like, won a round or had some sustained pockets of success, it didn't deter Gonzalez in any way. He didn't deviate from his game plan.
No, I was impressed that he was able to keep applying that kind of aggression, even in the face of a guy who was hitting him, you know, and a guy who was bigger than him. And maybe a little bit of a bigger puncher than him, I think, at this weight. We think of Gonzalez as a big knockout puncher. Mm-hmm. I worry, though, that as he keeps moving up and up and up through the ranks, that he's not quite the knockout artist that he was.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. He's still an awesome fighter, obviously, at this weight. Maybe probably the best in the world at this weight.
Yeah.
But I don't know if he's quite the destroyer that he was, you know, a little lower down.
That's fair to wonder. And I mean, like, you know, when he's 29 now, so he's, you know, maturing for sure. Mm-hmm. But he started at minimum weight. Let's not forget, you know.
He's a lot, you know, and he's steadily kept going up and up. He's his fourth weight class where he's won a title.
Yeah, it is. So, I mean, that's interesting because when you watch Gonzalez, we've got, even though his last fight against McWilliams Arroyo went the distance, he still battered Arroyo all over the ring, right? So you're kind of, I was kind of always waiting for that moment where he was really going to hurt Quadros badly and maybe, and, you know, knock him out maybe, but just kind of really take over and completely dominate the fight. And it didn't end up being that. And I think you have to give Quadros a lot of credit there because he showed that he may be one of, you know, the top fighters out there, too.
He absolutely, showed so much in this fight, I thought, Quadras. Gonzalez, you know, won the fight. I had him winning a narrow decision.
The 117-111 score was way too wide.
That was too wide for me as well. I thought Quadras was very impressive. His hand speed, the way he would flurry, and his movement, you know, the way that he handled the pressure of Gonzalez round after round after round, and he still kept all the snap on his punches. He still had plenty of gas in the tank after fending off, you know, one of the best pressure fighters in the sport for 12 rounds. That was the most impressive part, I think, about Quadras to me.
And that's something that you could easily overlook. Like, it is not easy to deal with the kind of pressure Roman Gonzalez puts on. He's a guy who's often throwing over 100 punches around.
Right.
And always coming forward.
Always, always. And coming forward, you know, very intelligently. You know, he doesn't give you a lot of opportunities to counter as he's coming in, like a lot of pressure fighters do. He applies very smart pressure. And, you know, the way he varies the strength on his punches, too, I think, is one of those very subtle things that makes him so great. Mm-hmm. You know, he'll hit you with two or three sort of, you know, off-speed pitches before he really comes in with the fastball down the middle.
Yeah.
No, not enough people vary the speed on their punches the way that Gonzalez does.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of fighters, you see, I think David Lemieux, for example, we've talked about, I think that's one of his problems, is that he's always coming in with bombs, you know, and with a smart boxer, they'll see that coming, you know, they'll be able to slip those big punches if that's all you're coming with. But Gonzalez, you never really know where the money punch is going to be coming. Mm-hmm. It could be on the second punch in the flurry, it could be on the fifth punch, you know, you never really know.
And it could be to the head or body.
Yeah.
With equal effectiveness. You know, one of the big fights out there, and it's nice to hear people talking about this, is Gonzalez against the Japanese phenom, Naoya Inoue. And that's a fight that needs to happen. And that's a fight that is more than worthy of headlining HBO. I wonder, though, if... Because Inoue is only 23,
I believe.
23 now, he just turned 23. You know, I wonder if they might pair them on a card to get him some exposure over here, because he's never fought stateside. But I feel like, you know, just like with Gonzalez, once people get the chance to see him, they're going to be on board. And I could almost see, I'd love to see, to be perfectly honest with you, a rematch of Gonzalez Quadras headlining with Inoue in a co-feature. I mean, that seems very unlikely in the sense that, you know, selling... 115-pound fighter as the main event's hard enough as it is. Mm-hmm. To have two fights at that weight would be, unfortunately, probably a very hard sell. But whether it's Gonzalez Quadras next or Gonzalez Inoue, either of those fights are ones that have to happen. Do you think because the fight was so close, does it, I mean, affect Gonzalez's stock at all in terms of being pound-for-pound number one?
I don't think so. Like the only question for me is about his power moving up weight classes at this point.
Yeah.
But I think really this was more about how good Cuadras was.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would diminish Gonzalez at all. In fact, I think winning a war against another elite level fighter like that, if anything, it should only add to how, yeah, the way we feel about him.
Yeah.
I think it would be underestimating Cuadras.
Yeah.
To say that this somehow exposed Gonzalez in any way.
Yeah.
This is Gonzalez going in against another top-tier, world-class fighter.
Yeah.
And you know, being able to continuously apply pressure even to the end. I thought there would become a point where Gonzalez would kind of would snap. Mm-hmm. You know, he wouldn't be able to be quite as aggressive just because Cuadras still had so much left in the tank.
Yeah.
And was really hitting him with some pretty stinging shots, hitting him quite a bit more than he's used to.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. I mean, as great as Cuadras was, he just wasn't quite able to completely turn the fight around, you know, in his favor.
Like, right.
He won a lot of rounds, but he was never able to just take it that little extra bit, you know?
Right.
To get Gonzalez, whether it's on the back foot or to slow him down significantly.
No, yeah.
Yeah.
He wasn't able to control the, you know, the ring geography,
yeah,
of that fight. Gonzalez was able to dictate where the fight was taking place.
Yeah.
Cuadras, I thought, used effective movement in spurts.
Yeah.
But often he was just kind of, to me, like, he was sort of
reacted to Gonzalez more, right, than he was forcing Gonzalez to react to him. And I think that in a fight that's that close and that competitive, the guy who's able to dictate the tempo and the guy who's being more aggressive is going to get that little extra nod, you know, generally, mm-hmm, when it's that competitive and that close.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought the way that Gonzalez was able to continually kind of cut off the ring, mm-hmm, put the fight in places where he wanted the fight to go, force him back against the ropes, force, mm-hmm, him to be, like you said, the one that's reacting instead, mm-hmm, of dictating the action.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was the little edge that gave him the win in this one.
Yeah. I saw a number of people who felt it could have been a draw. You know,
I don't think that's totally crazy.
No, I don't think so either. I think the 115-113 scorecard is very good that Max Shaluka, sure, turned in. At the highest end, 116-112, like that's about as wide as you can go, I think.
Yeah, I thought Gonzalez just did too much early.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of built up a lead, and Cuadras, I thought, didn't totally, close the gap.
It took him a while or longer to settle in, but once he did, you had to be impressed with some of the adjustments he made and what he had to offer. I mean, he...
Super impressed.
Yeah. It's interesting because when you look at like Golovkin-Brook, Cuadras had to do a lot of the same thing in terms of backup, sidestep, find those moments to stop and stand his ground, and he did it so effectively in spots. And that's what won him rounds, because I think there were those points where he was bringing Gonzalez to him, and when he would stop, he would outthrow him and then get out of the way again and outland him. You know, he had those stretches where he did a really admirable job of that.
Yeah, he really showed off his hand speed in those parts of the fight where he was able to flurry quickly and move
punching
out of the way.
Yeah,
and he was hitting Gonzalez with some pretty significant shots. You know, it's not like he was just speed bag, like pity pat kind of punches. This was a guy who was landing with some serious leather, especially in the middle of the fight.
He was, and I hope we see him back on TV, even if he doesn't get the Gonzalez fight again, because I mean, he's a good TV fighter, Cuadras.
Yeah, he's a really, really good fighter, and really happy to have seen him in a main event.
Yeah, for sure. Let's move on. We'll go back in time to the Friday before the two fights we just talked about. When you wrote about this,
not as good a fight.
I think you put it best. It was a fight that perhaps only Sergio Mora's handlers were really interested in.
Yes.
That was Daniel Jacobs.
And that includes Daniel Jacobs, yes.
That was Daniel Jacobs, Sergio Mora 2, a rematch of a very strange kind of two-round firefight they had months and months ago,
mm-hmm,
where they both went down in the first round. Great first round. Extremely entertaining. And then Jacobs seemed to knock Mora down again in the second round, maybe a bit of a push involved, and Mora, you know, turned that ankle and fractured it. And because Mora had that really nice knockdown of Jacobs on a beautiful counter left hook in the first fight, it there was enough there for him to sort of start, you know, calling for the rematch, and had I not hurt my ankle, you know, so on and
sure.
so forth.
Sure.
So it happened. It wasn't a fight we needed to see, and the result clearly confirmed that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, God bless Sergio Mora. I think back to the first season of The Contender.
We love The Contender guys on this
show. Yeah, I was a sucker for that show, definitely. Especially at that time.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's an interesting guy. You know, he's a...
He's very articulate.
Articulate, well-read guy. I think who compared his journey on The Contender to the little boy in The Alchemist.
Yes. I remember that.
Yes, he did, in fact. So, you know, I'm in his corner, more or less. And, you know, I, to be fair to him, too, I think he's been... as I think I wrote in the article that I had about this fight, he's been in more fun fights than you would think for a guy with his style.
Right.
Like, his fights with Peter Manfredo, I think, were actually quite fun.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, he had a pretty fun scrap with Vernon Forrest, too, I think, that he ended up winning,
yeah,
surprisingly.
That's where he won the title. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and like you said, the first round of Jacobs Mora was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But he also has some very bad fights, and I think this one was more, frankly, in the latter camp.
Yeah.
He was, you know, I think Roy Jones mentioned this in round one, he was like shadow boxing, you know? He was, like, not interested in getting anywhere near Daniel Jacobs in round one. And I think Jacobs, you know, intelligently, you know, wasn't too eager. To close the gap early on.
He clearly learned his lesson. You know, there's that adage that the wounded foe can sometimes be the most dangerous one, and it's something like every fighter is told, but until you really experience it for yourself, you know, maybe you can kind of dismiss it a bit. And that's what happened to Jacobs. I mean, in that first fight, he just kind of rushed in, squared himself up.
He had no respect whatsoever for Mora's power. I don't think it was a super impactful knockdown either, to be fair. It was kind of a flash knockdown.
Yeah.
I don't think Jacobs was really hurt.
But still, I mean, he showed a lot of discipline in this fight, and interesting the way he switched stances. You know, he spent a lot of time at southpaw, and obviously he flashed that power that he's known for, and he's got legitimate power, Danny Jacobs does.
Big time power.
And a very good athlete, you know, so...
He's a great athlete for a middleweight.
I mean, in terms of the fight itself, I mean, what, were there like 5 knockdowns or something?
It was getting kind of like Keystone Cops-ish but in the last round. Mora seemed to be going down with every punch.
Yeah, so I mean, there's really not much to break down from the fight itself. I mean, the more interesting thing to talk about, I think, is... You know, Jacobs has said he wants to fight Golovkin. Now he has, like, the WBA regular title or whatever, so, like, a minor version of the WBA title Golovkin has, so he's entitled to that fight. Do you think his bluff will be called, or do you think he's serious now at this point?
I hope he's serious, because that's a fight I want to see.
Yeah, in terms of the available options at 160... Yeah, whether it's Billy Joe Saunders or Danny Jacobs, if Golovkin is actually intent on staying at the weight and continuing to clean out the division, those are fights we need to see.
I think Jacobs would be a very interesting fight, potentially. I think he's a big middleweight. He's a guy that Golovkin wouldn't totally be able to bully, I don't think, the way he's able to bully some other guys. Like, I think he's even bigger than a guy like David Lemieux.
Yeah.
Look at Jacobs, he's a broad-shouldered, tall, big middleweight.
He is.
You know, and he's got huge power. Great athlete. The way he's able to close distance at points with his foot speed was surprising to me a little bit in this fight.
Yeah, you wrote about that. That's something you found particularly impressive, huh?
The way he would kind of just explode into the pocket at certain points was intriguing to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Gets good angles on his shots from in close.
Too. Right. Yeah. And he seemed a little more fluid when he was doing that rather than just trying to kind of be mechanical behind his jab. When he was really kind of rushing in, like, he kind of... animated him in a way, I feel you know. I think that would be an interesting strategy to look into against Golovkin. Kind of try to maybe catch him off guard when Golovkin applies that kind of relentless pressure by kind of darting in quickly and maybe trying to get off one big punch.
Yeah, that's true. And I think if that fight does happen, you know, if I'm Danny Jacobs, that's what I'm thinking of, because you know, the thing you can worry about in that fight is we've seen him get in his one loss get knocked out and knocked out pretty heavily. So you wonder, okay, how's he going to stand up to Golovkin's punches? But he does have equalizing power, just like David Lemieux. So why not take the fight to Golovkin and see if you can make a dent? I mean,
yeah,
you know, punches just seem to bounce off Golovkin's face like nothing. You know, it's kind of freaky almost, that big head of his. But like, yeah, why not? Go for broke if you're going to get the fight.
Yeah, I mean, if he's able to get Golovkin a bit on the back foot, we saw against Brook that he's not super comfortable in that position.
Yeah.
You know, if you have him on the, if you have him as the one who's kind of having to react and back up and avoid the big power shots.
Yeah.
You know, if you're flurrying on him, he didn't seem very comfortable with that.
And the thing with Golovkin too is when you see him either when his when his pressure gets stymied or when he gets backed up a little bit, he kind of just like will take the shots and then just like give a nod or whatever. And then it's like every time he does that, the opponent just kind of backs off. You know, they'll have some success landing, but no one like keeps going.
Right, because they don't want to eat that left hook to the liver, exactly. You know?
But what if someone like a Danny Jacobs is able to land that flurry, get Golovkin's attention, and then instead of just like backing up and being like, okay, I'm going to take that success and not press the issue, what if he does press the issue after?
I mean, he's got a big right hand, does Danny Jacobs. When he fires that right down the pipe,
yeah.
Like he can hurt Golovkin if he's able to find that punch. If that fight happens, you know, we could go into more depth. But I do wonder just about the fluidity of Jacobs a little bit. Yeah. You know, he goes through stretches where he just is too tense, I feel like.
Yeah.
He just seems like, I think he needs to get out of his own head a little bit sometimes even.
Yeah.
You know, he just seems like he's thinking too much at points, yeah. Rather than just sort of reacting and letting his hands go and just sort of using his athleticism, you know, his athletic gifts a little bit more than he does at points.
Yeah, I hope Heyman lets him. You know, if Jacobs is serious and we're taking him at his word, I hope Al Heyman lets that fight happen. Because at this point now, you know, they built up Danny Jacobs nicely, you know, very good story after returning from cancer and stuff. And he's got, like, this minor world title belt, and he's a draw at the Barclays Center. But now, if you're not going to step him up into the bigger fights at 160, he's just going to flatline, you know, in terms of his development as a fighter.
Right. Yeah, I think And as far as his, you know, his ability to be a draw as well, to be sort of a bigger name in the division, that's not going to happen if he doesn't fight some of the other title holders in the division, including Golovkin.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, basically, you know, Jacobs, he did what he had to do here. And you know,
in a fight I don't think he really wanted to be
no,
fair. I just think this was the best of a group of bad options for him, basically.
Yeah, yeah, he kind of got stuck with it, and had said so, like, pretty bluntly.
I don't think he wanted this fight at all. I think he was kind of just, you know, he wanted to get it over with more than anything else.
Yeah, but looked really good doing it. And
he did.
We wanted to see that kind of flawless performance from him. Interestingly, I found the co-feature here that's been a bit of a PBC trend, maybe, where you've had some really interesting co-features that have been far more compelling than the main events. And this was yet another one where Robert Easter Jr., who unfortunately for him is mentored by Adrian Broner.
Oh, God.
But a really good fight against Richard Comey.
Really fun fight, yeah.
In Ghana. And I had the chance to speak to Comey before the fight, and you know, he comes from a very interesting area in Accra where, like, Ike Corte and, Joshua Claudie, and then, you know, Azuma Nelson, you know, all these great Ghanaian fighters have all come from this really small section of Accra and become world champions. So he was really, like, looking to follow in their footsteps, and very nearly did. I mean, this was, in terms of a decision, like, about as a toss-up of a fight as you can get. And
very close fight.
It was that 12th round from Easter that really did it. I mean, where he... I don't know how Comey stayed on his feet.
That was... I mean, for anyone who missed this fight, Comey in round 12 got rocked.
Right hand, huh?
Rocked by Easter.
Yeah.
He was out on his feet,
and
but
that knee
somehow
did so close to the canvas.
Yeah, he was able to kind of do the limbo and sort of like keep that knee just that was as close as you can come to being knocked down without getting knocked down.
Yeah,
and the fact that he was able to kind of recover from that and actually end up going down in that round was insane to me.
Yeah,
I mean, insane. Just the fact that he was able to stay upright.
Yeah,
I mean, his knees were buckled. He was out on his feet,
and somehow
he summoned just enough to kind of keep himself upright. Unbelievable, truly.
Yeah, I mean, this is a fight between two big punchers. Like going into the fight, Easter had 14 KOs and 17 wins, and Comey 22 KOs and 24 wins, and they both had interesting momentum swings. You had some nice stretches of both guys seizing the initiative. Comey dropped Easter with a beautiful counter shot in round 8, and I think, I don't know if on the replay it showed that his glove hadn't quite touched the canvas, but
it was borderline.
It was ruled a knockdown. He was clearly hurt
by
the punch, you know, similar to round 12, not as badly maybe. But yeah, it looked like he may have touched the canvas with his glove.
Yeah, and on one of those looping right hands that Comey, it was very impressive with that punch, that kind of looping overhand right. He was really able to find a home for that a lot in this fight.
Easter's an interesting lightweight. I mean, he's so tall, you know, 5'11". Comey did a good job of dealing with that, but you also saw at times that, you know, Comey's a guy who applies a lot of pressure and is very aggressive. So that can also be difficult for a guy as tall as Easter to deal with if you keep letting a guy get inside of you. But I thought he did a pretty good job on the whole of managing distance, because there looked to be a few moments where Comey was maybe starting to take over the fight.
Yeah,
just going to bully him on the inside.
Yeah, I think Easter, you know, he's very upright in his style, and I think Comey was sort of using that to his advantage at points. He was lunging in with that overhand right, and as Easter's kind of backing up, he's able to kind of hit with that punch. Just because of how aggressive he was, like you said, the way he almost leaps in with that punch, you know.
Yeah. And, I wonder what'll happen to Comey, because, you know, he hasn't... This was only the second time he's fighting in the States, and I really hope he doesn't just kind of disappear off our TV screens for, like, 2 years, and then, you know, we see him and he's knocking out some prospect, you know, like, later on. Because, first of all, I mean, this is a fight that easily warrants a rematch. I mean, it was that close and competitive.
Yeah.
But lightweight is also a very open division. You have Jorge Linares, who's... sort of distinguished himself recently as kind of the best 135-pounder. He's got an interesting fight coming up in the UK, I believe, against Anthony Crawla, and that's, I think, a unification fight. I'm going to look that up just to double-check, but that's big. But it's a division that kind of lacks star power at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, Anthony Crawla. So it's going to be... just for the WBA, for Crawla's WBA title. Yeah, so that's a good fight, but someone like Easter is very much in the mix, as is Comey still. Like, you know, these are guys who could clearly prove that they're top lightweights in an open division, and it really wouldn't surprise me to see Comey get another title shot, you know, soon, assuming his handlers, you know, maneuver him properly in that sense.
I don't see why not. I thought he was very impressive. I thought he was a very fun fighter to watch.
Yeah, good, you know, great guy, TV fight.
Yeah, he really laid it on the line, you know, and that heart and that chin, frankly, to withstand that shot in round 12 was amazing. I mean, that was an unbelievable moment.
And with Easter, too, you know, it's a guy who only had 17 fights coming in, and, you know, had a very nice win over Argenis Mendez in his last fight before this one, a former champion, and that looked really good on his resume. But other than that, we were kind of wondering, okay, that's a good performance, but there wasn't a whole lot of a big body of work behind that, you know, especially against top, against recognizable opposition. So he showed that, you know, he can dig deep too. He's got more than just the sort of flashy skills and natural athleticism and talent. Like, he's a fighter.
Absolutely.
Easter. And that's nice to see in a guy who's, you know, being hyped and built up as a prospect. And we'd seen him before the Mendez fight, but against much softer touches, you know, where he was supposed to shine and look good. So this was one where I like it. You throw a guy who's one of your top prospects in a 50-50 fight and see what happens. And both of them stepped up. And Easter, hey, you got to give him credit for that last little push over the finish line.
He was the way that he was able to withstand Comey's pressure and, you know, keep his power, the way it held, his power held up through the rounds. I thought was very impressive. I thought his counter punching was very impressive. And, you know, he did just enough to edge another very good fighter. And for a 25-year-old guy who hasn't really been in there against very many top level guys, as you said, you know, that's very, very encouraging.
It is. It is. Let's, you know, as we get close to the end, we got a preview. You know, there's lots of recaps, so we're going to just look at the one big fight coming up. Mexican Independence Day weekend. It's a tradition of sorts, right? Mm-hmm. We have always a big fight, and this is the first time Canelo's headlining as the A-side. He's been there, the Floyd Mayweather fight happened to be during that weekend. So he's been involved in big fights on that weekend. But now they're sort of cementing this.
And last year he fought Cotto, I believe, on that weekend as well. Yeah.
And so, you know, now we're... Or Cotto, I think, might have been November.
I don't recall.
He fought James Kirkland Cinco de Mayo, I believe. And anyway, but now...
It was November.
Now so. Canelo's graduated to being the guy who's going to headline in mid-September... Cinco de Mayo, the big Mexican fighter. I need to ask you, though, before we even talk about his upcoming fight against Liam Smith, where he's moving back down officially to 154 to challenge Smith for Smith's WBO world title. How do you feel about Canelo? As a boxing writer and also as someone of Mexican heritage.
I really like him. I don't think he's, you know... I think he's more of a TV star than, like, one of the best fighters in the world, actually, you know? He's a fun fighter stylistically.
Yeah.
I still think he's sort of limited in certain ways that I don't know that he's... that he can really overcome against the very best. Mostly with just as far as his footwork and his foot speed, I think he's that still leaves a lot to be desired. But you know, I think he's made real improvements too, though. Over the years, he's gotten a lot stronger. He's kind of grown into his power. He's got real knockout power. You look at his knockout percentage; it's a little misleading because he had a bunch of fights as a teenager.
Yeah, he turned pro at 15 or whatever. You know.
So, but as he's grown into, you know, as he's really grown into the weight. His power has been very impressive, as you saw against Amir Khan.
Yeah, and James Kirkland, too. Right. I mean, those were two stunning knockouts.
Yeah, and I think he's very impressive the way he lets his hands go. He can throw combinations. He's a very good offensive fighter. He's a smart offensive fighter, too. He's not reckless. You know, he works behind his guard very effectively.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just wonder against the super high-level boxer... How well can he really do against a guy who's going to be able to offer the sort of speed, the countering, the high level technical boxing ability? Can he beat that type of fighter?
Yeah, that's true. I've always been impressed too with Canelo's demeanor for a guy who really kind of graduated to the spotlight at a young age. He's got that kind of like unflappable air about him.
That's true. He's done a lot of big moments for such a young fighter, right?
And handled it with a lot of maturity, you know?
Yeah, even when he got wiped out by Floyd Mayweather, he didn't give up on the fight. You know, even though it was a total wipeout and he got dominated every second of that fight, he was still trying to find a way in past the Mayweather's defense, you know, going well into the later rounds of the fight. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, he had no answer, but he was still
looking
trying.
For him.
He was trying.
Yeah, for sure. How do you feel, though, about this whole Golovkin situation and Canelo at middleweight? I mean, the Cotto fight, I'm glad we saw that fight, and it was a compelling bout. But there was definitely an element of, you know, cherry picking for the middleweight title there. Like, it was an ideal time to fight Cotto, let's be honest.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, Cotto was, I think, clearly on the other side of the hill by that point.
Yeah.
Size-wise, he's not really a true middleweight. As Canelo, you could probably argue, is not entirely a middleweight either, I think, physically. I think he can get there.
Yeah.
I think he should, frankly, if he wants to keep the middleweight title.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Clearly, the Liam Smith fight is not one that most people were clamoring for, I feel like.
Yeah.
It's sort of an odd choice for Canelo at this point. I don't know if he really wants to fight at 160, is really what it comes down to. And until he proves that he's willing to do that, there's always going to be sort of an asterisk, I feel like, but beside his name as the lineal middleweight champ.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see, because assuming he wins this fight, what's his sort of... plan for the next year and a half, let's say, before the Golovkin fight's supposed to happen, according to them? I mean, is he looking to unify at 154? Is he just gonna sort of cherry pick, like, kind of name opponents that are bigger events than they are interesting fights, you know what I mean? Which was kind of the case with Amir Khan.
Absolutely.
Is that what's gonna happen? Because at some point, as beloved as Canelo is by a lot of people, you know, the Mexicans more than most are very discerning boxing fans. You know, like they're not going to put up with that forever. And I don't want to be too critical of Canelo because I think he's made a lot of interesting choices. Like even fighting someone like Arislandi Lara when no one wanted him to. I mean, that shows that he's up for a challenge.
Yeah.
But at some point, especially this Golovkin thing is looming, and I don't think the Liam Smith fight's a bad fight, but. You know, we're frustrated with it because of that move up to middleweight and then the refusal to fight Golovkin when he made that big speech like, oh, Mexicans don't fuck around, you know, in the ring after when talking about the Golovkin fight.
I think it's going to be sort of a millstone around his neck until he fights Golovkin. People aren't going to forget it. Mm-hmm. You know, the longer it takes, the more criticism he's going to take for it. Mm-hmm. I think if the fight doesn't happen next fall, he's going to look like the bad guy. You know, the guy who wouldn't want to fight. The guy who was running from Golovkin. And I don't know that you can be the top draw in the sport if you're perceived that way. You know, so I really think as far as his brand, if he's thinking about protecting his sort of pay-per-view status, his status as maybe the top draw in the sport, I think he'd be much better off fighting Golovkin than avoiding him.
Yeah, that's a good point.
No matter how the fight ends up going, you know what I mean? I mean, people think of Floyd Mayweather as the model, right? That you have to have that zero on your record if you're going to be the top guy. It doesn't have to be that way.
No.
Look at Oscar De La Hoya.
And it wasn't like that until Mayweather started the trend.
No. I mean, look at De La Hoya. He was the biggest pay-per-view star in the sport. He lost a bunch of high-profile fights.
He lost more of the high-profile fights than he won.
You could make that argument, frankly. And he was the top draw in the sport.
Great fighter.
Absolutely. No. First ballot Hall of Famer, great fighter. But he lost a lot of high-profile fights, and he was still the top draw in the sport.
Yeah.
I think the same would be true for Canelo. If he goes in, puts on a credible performance against Golovkin.
As long as he doesn't
get
KO'd in like a round.
Right. You know? I mean, as long as he doesn't get totally wiped out. And I don't think, to be fair to Canelo, I don't think he would get totally wiped out.
I don't think so either.
I think he could put together a very credible performance against Golovkin. Mm-hmm. And if he actually had his moments against Golovkin and managed to hurt Golovkin, then we're talking about, you know, like seriously increasing your stock, even if you lose that fight.
Yeah.
Even if Golovkin eventually catches up with him in round 8 or 9, let's say, and puts him away. If Canelo is able to get a lot of offense in the meantime, maybe bloody up Golovkin, hurt him a bit, that does nothing but good things for his brand.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you just hope he'll realize that at some point because... You know, we've talked about, you know, plateauing and flatlining. He's going to quickly get to the point where, you know, the marquee opponents that he's been facing over the last few years are ones that have come with either major asterisks or qualifications, you know, like Khan moving up 2 weight classes, very small. But yeah, he's a big name and he's fast, you know, so he presents that challenge. Cotto, smaller too, also over the hill, but huge name. And it's a fight people have been wanting for about a year and a half.
Yeah,
you know? So
definitely. And there were still people, I mean, there were questions about where Cotto was. I think people had a higher estimation of Cotto than where he actually was at that point of his career, at the point
of
that fight. He had
three nice wins, but against, let's be honest, very middling opposition.
Yes,
He looked good, and I think there was, you know, definitely some substance to that kind of... resurgence on his part, but yeah, when you saw him in with Canelo, it was like he had a few moments. It was an interesting fight, but he was like second best for pretty much the entire fight.
Yeah.
Credit to Canelo for that.
That was a great fight for him. Maybe his defining fight so far.
But let's talk about the Liam Smith fight, of course, because you know we wouldn't be giving Smith we haven't given Smith enough credit yet. He's a good fighter.
Yes,
he was a very good amateur. A couple of things intrigued me about this fight. A, you have a guy who's a really solid and strong junior middleweight, and it's been you know a few fights since we've seen Canelo against someone of his own size, you know, and strength. So that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that intrigues me about Smith is while you know he's got a thin resume, let's be honest, he has knocked out his last 8 opponents, and when you look at the fact that only 13 KOs and 23 wins, he's clearly grown into some power as well. And he's a tough lad, as they might say over there, you know. So I think that this is actually... I don't think this is going to be an easy fight for Canelo. I really don't. I don't know if it's just more of a gut feeling, but I don't see this as... I see Smith as really having some moments in this fight.
I agree. I think this could be a tougher fight for Canelo than he's perhaps bargaining for here, which is the other side of why this fight doesn't make so little sense to me for... frankly, from Canelo's point of view, the risk-reward calculus here doesn't make any sense to me. Smith is not a guy who's selling pay-per-views, and he's a guy who's going to give you a real fight. This isn't a soft touch, like even like the Khan fight, where it's like Khan was going to have his moments, but we all knew how that fight was going to end, right?
It was scripted from the moment it was signed.
And I don't think that he can just depend on, you know, my power will eventually carry the day against a guy like Liam Smith. Like you said, he's a guy who's younger than Khan, I think bigger.
Oh, yeah, much bigger,
Tougher.
Yeah.
You know.
Sturdier, you know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, he's a stouter dude. And,
yeah.
And he's a very good body puncher. So I actually think we could see some pretty awesome action here because Smith is not a slickster, you know? He's not someone who's going to lead you around the ring off his back foot, throw flurries, and get out of the way. He's a guy who is going to be in your chest.
And maybe that's what Canelo's kind of depending on, really, in this fight. You figure...
We've seen Canelo thrive against that kind of opponent.
Right. Yeah, I do think that that is kind of the perfect type of opponent for Canelo. Pressure fighters. He's just... He's very smart with his guard and with counter-punching. And I think he's just able to pick apart pressure fighters, and when you factor in his power, you know, eventually he's just going to find that counter shot and put you away, like you saw with very early with James Kirkland, right?
The last two guys Canelo's fought, like, I mean, I guess I'll say somewhat similar to Smith, like Kirkland, like you just mentioned, and Angulo. The encouraging thing is Liam Smith is far more skilled and better than both those guys.
Yes, that's true.
So he'll be there, and he'll be there to hit, but he's also going to offer a lot more in return. I mean, you know, Kirkland tried to overwhelm Canelo at the beginning. Smith is more precise with his punches. He'll apply pressure, he has the capability of applying pressure, but in a much more intelligent and methodical way.
So it sounds like you're expecting a pretty exciting fight then, at least.
I am. I would actually be disappointed if it wasn't. You know, if Canelo were to blow Smith out, I would be very disappointed.
I'd be super impressed with Canelo, frankly, if he's able to do that to Liam Smith.
I would, yeah. That's true. I for some reason, like, you know, with Smith, I just see it that this is a guy, he comes from good fighting stock, you know, the Smith family, all four brothers are top fighters, or have been at one point. Paul's definitely on the way down at this point, but good fighting family, good amateur background. He's sort of come up the typical British way, you know? And they do a good job domestically of getting guys in British title fights, Commonwealth titles.
They've done a very good job, I think, of cultivating young talent in the sort of British boxing scene the last few years. You've seen a lot of interesting young fighters
coming out of England. They definitely have. And so the thing, though, is we don't know. I mean, this is a huge step up in class for Liam Smith. And that's the big variable, right? Canelo has been in there. I mean, he's been in there with the best fighter in the world. Even though he lost a wide decision, he has that experience.
Right,
and he doesn't have.
Yeah, absolutely. And you wonder, once you get into, you know, you're talking, this is going to be a much bigger event than Liam Smith's ever been in, and a much bigger venue. I believe
Cowboys Stadium.
I believe it's his first time in
America.
In America, if I'm not mistaken.
He's
certainly in this level of fight.
He's only fought in the UK.
That's right. So he's coming over to America for the first time. So it's going to be very interesting to see how he responds to that. You know, I think it's bit of an underrated factor when you step into this kind of high profile spotlight fight. He's going to be dealing with media like he's never dealt before. It's just a whole different ballgame when you step up onto this level. And Canelo's been living at this level since his early 20s, right?
He has. And I think that's going to carry the day with that, combined with the fact that I do just believe that Canelo is more skilled.
I think he's a slightly more skilled fighter, too. I agree. I think his counter-punching is ultimately going to carry the day. I think he ultimately finds a home for that big left hook. And I like him to knock out Smith later on in this fight. I think Smith is going to give a very good account of himself, but I could see Canelo breaking him down and maybe finishing the deal by around 9 or 10.
That's a very likely scenario. I mean, I think we'll sort of be able to tell by like the fourth or fifth round whether this has late stoppage or distance fight over it, because I'm going to be looking for Canelo to try to make an impression early. Like, I feel for him, because of everything that's gone on with Golovkin, and now he's decided to move back down to 154, I'm really expecting him to come out with a lot of authority early. Like, Smith is in his backyard, you know, they're in Texas, there are going to be a lot of Mexican fans there.
Yep.
Like you said, it's a big event, the kind Canelo's accustomed to. He's the big A-side draw, it's Mexican Independence Day weekend. He's pretty unflappable, like we said, so the pressure definitely won't get to him. I expect him to really come out and boss that action, and I'm going to be curious to see if Smith is a little hesitant early and is backing up more than usual, or if he holds his ground and tries to, you know, give as good as he's getting.
Yeah, this could potentially be a very interesting fight, definitely.
I think it honestly could be won in the body-punching battle. You know, they're both good body punchers. They both commit to throwing downstairs, and I just feel like Canelo, at the end of the day, has more firepower. You know, he's faster hands, maybe a bit more fluid with his punches, and I do think that nice upper body movement we've seen from Canelo that he's sort of honed over the last several fights, I think is going to factor, and I think Smith is going to have a harder time hitting him upstairs than he thinks going in.
Yeah, I think Canelo is going to carry the day with his counter-punching in this one.
Yeah, but you know, I still think it's got the potential to be an exciting, worthwhile fight. I hope too, in some ways, that the Golovkin situation doesn't, you know, cast too much of a shadow over. I mean, it's something we have to talk about, but at the same time, if this is a good fight, I hope people like acknowledge it as a good fight.
Yeah, I do think that this fight is going to kind of be a pleasant surprise in a certain sense. I think a lot of people just are expecting Canelo just to roll through Smith here. But it might not end up that way.
I think it could be good for Canelo if it doesn't. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think if this is a real firefight and he comes out on top, then all of a sudden maybe that fight gets a little bit bigger, right, potentially with Triple G.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Because we want to see him at the end of the day. Canelo's so good and really good to the point where we want to see him in those tough matchups.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's close today. We're going to go off boxing, I know you wanted to talk a bit about the Hall of Fame, the NBA Hall of Fame induction class, particularly one Allen Iverson.
Sure. Yeah. I figured we'd take the last few minutes today to talk about the great Georgetown alum.
Yeah. Man, when the Sixers made the NBA Finals with AI back in, what was it, 2001?
2001.
I mean, I was so desperate for anyone to disrupt that Lakers reign of terror.
Oh, and God, they were so freaking obnoxious, those Lakers teams.
And that game one performance from Iverson, and, you know, what was it, over 40 points, and the step over of Toronto in overtime, I mean... That was just one of the most exciting basketball games I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, and I think the factor that gets overlooked here, a lot of people kind of view that season as like, oh, this is a very bad era for the East. Mm. The Sixers team wasn't very good. They were sort of lucky to be there kind of thing. They only won one game in the finals. This was against the Lakers juggernaut that year. That was the only game they lost all playoffs, was that game one to the Sixers.
Really? Wow.
They did not lose a single other game that playoff run.
Do you remember who they swept along the way?
Oh, gosh. I don't entirely remember. But the West was for real at that point, right? The Lakers were clearly the class of the West.
Yeah. Do you remember if they played the Kings that year?
I think they did. I will have to look this up after, but that was the year where they famously, like, I think that's the best record ever in the playoffs, where they went 16-1. And, you know, this was the height of Shaq Kobe.
Yeah.
The fact that Iverson came in game one and was the best player on the floor, you know, he was...
I mean,
he was unbelievable.
The phrase, that whole season. Someone willing their team to victory gets overused, but it was really the case in that game. And just like the whole season to get them to that point, it was put by Iverson's sheer will and determination and skill, obviously.
He was unbelievable.
What do you think is the ultimate legacy of Iverson? I mean, he was a very colorful figure.
Yeah.
A phenomenal scorer. My God, he was an unbelievable scorer. You know, was the man on some very good Sixer teams. You know, we should acknowledge, even though, maybe the East wasn't as strong as it's been at other points. But still, I don't know. I mean, how do you remember Iverson? Like, how do you think he's ultimately remembered?
The thing I remember most about Iverson, I do feel like his legacy is a complicated one for a lot of reasons, both on and off the court.
Yeah.
I think people are especially as advanced stats become more and more prevalent, people are going to look back at Iverson and think, he was a little bit overrated. He wasn't that efficient. Mm-hmm. He shot way too many threes and he missed most of them.
Yeah.
That's
true.
But I think all of that ignores the context, for one. I think he was asked to do things on that Philadelphia team that just, like, we're not going to lend itself to being the most efficient guy, mm-hmm. you know, but that was what he was asked to do, and that was the role that he played. And the thing I most remember about Iverson is just he would bring it every single night. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember watching a lot of Raptors games those years, and the quality of those Raptors teams during Iverson's career, you know, ebbed and flowed, let's say, to be kind.
For sure.
But no matter how good, bad, middling, Iverson killed the Raptors every single time I watched them play. He was putting up 38, 45,
yeah.
and this could be in the middle of the season. You know, the Sixers could have been good, bad, whatever. He was putting up his, 40 points on the Raptors every time they played.
For sure. And of course before this past year's playoff run, that was a great series between Toronto and Philadelphia, yeah. which was the high water mark for the Raptors up till very recently. And again, that was a memorable series for us for obvious reasons, but also just because it was a great duel, right, between the, mm-hmm. the plucky Raptors trying to
They traded to Vince Carter and Iverson, trading 50-point games in that series.
That's
a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. I think with Iverson too, you know, you mentioned advanced stats, and that's interesting because I think those of us who grew up watching him play or had the chance to watch his career, whether it was completely from start to finish or even just the prime of his career, you'd be able to appreciate him in a far different way than if you just look back on him, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you just look at the way that those Sixers teams were assembled, whether you want to say that's because of Iverson's sort of force of will and they were trying to cater to that, maybe that was a factor, but there was just not a lot of guys on that team that could create their own offense, you know? Right. It was Allen and that's it. And, you know, the occasional kick-out three and offensive rebound, that's what these guys were capable of on the Sixers, you know?
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like when they were at their best, their second kind of most viable scoring option was Aaron McKee mm-hmm. on the bench. Right.
Yeah, I think McKee was arguably their second best player, and he was a fine player, but I mean, that's not a team that should be making the finals, frankly,
even
in a weakened East, and Iverson just willed them there, you know, because he was just so relentless, the way he attacked the paint over and over and over again, he was mm-hmm. getting to the line, he was, you know, he was just so fearless around the basket.
Yeah.
His quickness, his athleticism, you know, I think in a different situation, he could have been kind of Isaiah Thomas 2.0.
Yeah.
I think he was a much better passer than people give him credit for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when he was in situations where, you know, he was asked to play more of a point guard role, where he was asked maybe not to shoot as much, his efficiency did improve. I think you saw that later in his career with Denver. Mm-hmm. He had a pretty nice run one year with them where they were a seventh seed. And, mm-hmm. you know, he was very nice kind of second banana to Carmelo Anthony at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think, you know, his... Obviously, the just his effort level, his skill level, his athleticism, the style with which he played the game, too. I think all of these things... add up to mm-hmm. one of the most memorable players of his era, one of the best players of his era.
Definitely. And I think, you know, there are as many superstars or, you know, top players there are in the league, or even if you just look at as many guys as there are who are, 20-plus point scorers, it's rare that you have a guy who just truly commands your attention when you watch the game. And to me, there's something about Iverson, whether it was, you know, waiting for him to kind of take some crazy gamble on defense, going for mm-hmm. a steal, or, you know, his ball handling, of course, legendary.
Yeah.
Or just the way he would attack the rim. I mean, it was done with such, unbridled enthusiasm and passion. And it's something that just really kind of shone through. I mean, he was my favorite player at the time, you know, hands down.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you were younger, just the way that he played and, I mean, just the... sort of his just like, what kind of athlete he was. I think that's an easy thing to kind of forget with Iverson.
And he was dunking over people early in his career. Like, it was nobody's business.
And he was just unreal. He was a guy who was like 5'10".
Yeah.
This guy was not 6 feet tall. No. I know he was listed at that. This guy was 5'10".
Like 160 or something.
At 160, soaking wet.
Yeah.
And he's getting like 10, 12 free throw attempts a game, hitting the deck over and over and over again, and just popping back up.
Yeah.
You know, no hesitation going to the rim. And not to mention, the guy was an All-State quarterback as well.
That's true.
In high school.
Yeah, I forgot.
This guy was one of the best high school athletes we've ever seen, I think.
That's true. Yeah. Did you watch the 30 for 30, the no crossover?
Yes.
I haven't seen it. How was it?
It was pretty good. It was pretty good. I thought, I wish Iverson would have collaborated with it.
Right.
This is another way that, you know, off the court, I think he's made a lot of sort of questionable decisions, clearly. Mm. But I thought it was very interesting, and just the way that he sort of lost a whole season. He lost a whole season and still came out of it, you know, unscathed as far as his athletic ability.
Right.
You know, he didn't seem to lose anything by losing that year of development, which is just shows how special, frankly, an athlete he is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Kind of fitting that he went into the Hall of Fame in some ways the same year as Shaq, huh?
Yeah, and, yeah. I think both of them are very... they will both define that era in different ways.
Absolutely. Yeah, and even with Yao Ming, it's funny that I think they said it was the most number one picks to ever go in the same year in the same Hall of Fame class. And guys who all left a really significant mark on the NBA in very different ways.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm curious to see what the future is going to hold for Allen Iverson. He does seem to have kind of turned a corner personally.
He went through a rough time.
There was a very rough patch for him from most accounts. You know, but it's good to see him. He seems to have turned a corner a little bit personally. Mm-hmm. Hopefully he can, you know, we'll be able to see him doing something in the game.
That's the thing. He would be a nice guy for the NBA to kind of bring back into the fold some way. I don't know how exactly that would happen, but... you know, he gave so much on the court and to the game that you feel like it'd be natural for them to find, you know, a role for him.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see what the next chapter holds for him. But congratulations to Allen Iverson. It gave us so many years of you know, entertaining basketball, and you know, he'll be missed.
And was the leading figure of that era where we were just so desperate for someone to will themselves past those damn Lakers,
He almost did it too. That series was a little more competitive, I think, than people might remember.
Absolutely. So yeah, good for Iverson, and yeah, it's nice to see that he's turned the corner, and you know, I guess we're thankful that he's not around to torch the Raptors anymore.
yeah. I think he's in the top three of Raptor killers over the years.
Kobe being number one.
Yeah.
And who else would you put up there?
Oh gosh, Paul Pierce. This is recent in my memory. I think he's a sneaky Raptor killer as well. But Iverson's definitely like in the Mount Rushmore of Raptor killers.
Well, that's very well said. All right, so we'll be back next week to talk about Canelo Smith and all the action that's unfolded since then, and to preview the fights going forward. Thanks for listening.